Access number 30283, Reel 6.
Barry Priest, Reel 6.
Yes, yeah, the fine thing, yes. And because the Naffy pack was the one they always claimed was the one they couldn't reclaim, that had got lost in the river or something, so they then got another one, you see. So they got double rations, that mother, by claiming that the Naffy pack had gone.
How often do you think you were successful?
Oh, I think most of the time, yes. I think most of the time. There was the odd occasion where they perhaps couldn't reach anything. Yes, I couldn't put a percentage figure on it. I don't think it was a great problem. I think the fact that they existed out there meant that they got the stuff. I mean, on some occasions, obviously, it was a bit of an epic getting it back. But anyway, on other occasions, I think there's always a famous occasion where they lost a bulldozer, which they dropped a bulldozer out of a Beverly, which... unfortunately, they'd chosen a DZ next to a river, and of course, it apparently just hit the bank of the river and then just slowly toppled into the river. So that sort of thing happened, which I don't know whether they replaced it or what they did. But
so you were dropping barbed wire, picket fences, oil drums, naffy packs. Anything else?
Well, yes, the basic food. Yeah, yes. At one stage, they decided that chickens can fly, so if you drop chickens out, they can. That should be all right. But apparently. What happened was that they dropped the chickens out, and I think it was in a sort of loose crate sort of thing, which immediately disintegrated in the airstream. The chickens sort of fluttered for about 10, 15, 20 feet, and then decided they had enough of that, and they folded their wings and just went straight down. So that wasn't very successful, I don't think. But obviously ammunition was something else that was dropped. But
And how were things packaged that they didn't... Because presumably they didn't want stuff to split, they wanted it to...
Yeah, I think a lot of it is sort of almost like the wickerwork hampers type of stuff, was obviously got some give in it when it hits the ground.
Did it tend to hold together?
Oh, I think so, yes, yeah. Yes, I think the main problem they had was the number of parachutes they used. It got quite expensive at some stage. I mean, of course, the other thing is that it's quite an attractive for... I was talking earlier on about the survival exercise, where parachute silk and the cord is very useful stuff for if you're making yourself comfortable in the jungle. So I dare say a few of those disappeared into the guys' living accommodation and making life a bit more comfortable. But
did you know much about the people you were supplying, about their how they were living, their conditions?
Not really, no. No, I think... we only ever operated from Kuching. I think some of the guys went further afield and stayed not that far from them, but not really. No, we didn't. Obviously we knew it was the Gurkhas and this sort of thing, but not what they were doing and how they were faring. It's amazing how little cross information went on. People lived in their own little worlds, doing their own little thing. And of course, reading Roger's book, it was quite interesting to see some of the things that he'd researched out that was going on.
I'm just wondering, have we covered that? Is there anything else that was happening during those times?
No, I think that probably pretty much covers it. We didn't have such a big commitment as the Argosys on the supply dropping. Mainly, I think, because the powers that be, having spent all that money in Argosys, wanted to make sure they got some return for the money, and they could say to people, "Well, the Argosys done all this," so they did a lot more of the supply work than we did. Also, the Argosy was not such a good route aeroplane; it didn't have the same range that we had, so we tended to do a lot more of the nice route flying than they did.
So how long were you there for, and what happens next?
63 to 66. Came back in 1966, and the question at the end of that tour was, what do you do? The normal progression is to do a co-pilot tour, which is what I'd done in Singapore. I had been shortlisted to be a PA to an air marshal out there, but one of the other guys on the squadron got that. Which in a way I wasn't sorry about. But the question was, do you go on as the normal course would be to co-pilot to captain. But I didn't really want to go as a captain on the Hastings, because it was coming to the end of its life and there was no great point in doing that on an aeroplane that was about to be taken out of service. Plus the fact that a good qualification to have in the Air Force is a qualified flying instructor. So I opted and applied to go to the Central Flying School to become a flying instructor. So in 66, came back from Singapore and went down to Little Rissington and did the course there, which was just under 6 months, and that was back on the Jet Provost. So just learning the skills of teaching people how to fly aeroplanes.
That's deceptively brief summary, that sounds like. What would that involve?
Well, basically, I describe the process of getting airborne and doing straight and level one, and the instructor shows you do that. But it was really just coming at it from the other side, that we got airborne with a central flying school instructor, an instructor of instructors, and then you would have learned the lesson plan, because they're all very structured lesson plans, and it was known as the patter. So you would then go through the patter for that lesson. So straight and level one, you'd say to blogs, always known as blogs. If you push students are always blogs, yes. I don't know if it still is in the Air Force, but they're always blogs. Blogs, if you push open the throttle, then you go fast, and if you pull the nose up. And so you were just coming from the other way. So you do that lesson, he'd show you his patter. You would then repeat it back to him. You would then land, and then you'd get airborne with another student, and you would give the patter to him, and he would give the patter back to you. So by the time you've done it three or four times, you've got some idea of what you had to cover. And I say the lesson plans were quite specific on what you had to cover. So it was just a whole series of flights like that. Not all as pedantic as that, but you do navigation flights, formation flying, again, just and the low flying. Teaching low flying. So
how do you teach low flying?
basically, you've got to you take the guy down there, probably starting off at 500 feet, and just let him experience it for a bit. Point out the problems to him, i.e., that at 10,000 feet you can see a lot more than you can at 500 feet. So your visual clues are much more difficult. Things happen much more quickly because you'll only see something for a brief time, so you've got to see it, recognise it, relate it to the route you want to fly. You teach him fuel management, because you're going to burn fuel a lot quicker down there than you are up at height, so fuel becomes important. Just the basic techniques of planning as accurately as possible. So going from A to B is so many miles, at 180 knots it's going to take you so long. So your stopwatch is one of your best navigational aids. So once you get down to 500 feet, if you plan that you're going to fly from A to B at 180 knots in that precise time, it becomes very important that you fly at 180 knots. So you've then got to teach the guy that he's got to fly very accurate speeds, very accurate headings. At the same time, got to look out, because you're not far off the ground at 500, and even more so at 250 feet, you see less. And once he's got some experience, so there are specific techniques that you've got to put across. And of course, in my low flying experience, I had a navigator who was doing that. So then you've got to recall your own time when you were going through training. And so it's a question of an instructor telling you how to teach it, and then you practicing on a guy, one of your fellow students, and slowly just develop the skills. But you don't really fully develop the skills until you actually get a raw blog yourself, who really is somebody. And
and teaching some of the other things you mentioned, navigation. Instrument flying, wasn't it?
Instrument flying, yeah. Yes. Again, demonstrate, show the guy. Obviously, a lot of ground instruction on something like instrument flying. What the instruments are, what the limitations are, and how to get the most information out of them. Again, with instrument flying, there's something they call the radial scan, which is one of the basics, which sounds perhaps quite easy to pick up. But the central thing, the central useful instrument is the artificial horizon, because that tells you, as it says, what your relationship is with the horizon, and whether you're going up, down, turning or not turning. So the scheme is on a central radial scan is that you watch that. That's your focus. And then you just go out to the speed. Is that the speed I want? Back to that. And if it's not the speed you want, you adjust the throttle accordingly. You know, and if you're turning, have I got the right? Am I turning at the right rate? Altimeter, am I going up or am I going down? You've got a vertical speed indicator, which will indicate if you're climbing or descending, which is useful in itself, but is even more useful that if you want to fly on instruments accurately, as soon as the vertical speed indicator, as soon as that needle starts to move one way or the other, if you adjust immediately, you can keep a very accurate height. But the trick always is, of course, is not to get stuck watching one, because while you're watching one, something else is going. So it's really a question of developing a radial scan and learning the little tricks and the techniques that can get you ultra accurate. Because if things start going wrong, if you do something about it straight away, it's easy. If it starts going wrong and you don't pick it up straight away, it's going wrong. Then you've got bigger corrections to make. You make a bigger correction, it's more difficult to get back to the precise state. You tend to go through and through, slowly settling down onto it. But if you want to fly on the rating scheme in the Air Force, again, I don't know if it still is, you have a white card as a basic instrument qualification. You had a green card when you were getting a bit better at it. If you were top of the pile, then you were a master green. But if you wanted to aspire to that sort of standard, then that was the... you had to get these techniques absolutely off and keep it there. And as soon as the airplane's trying to do something different, stop it. And the quicker you did that, the easier it became. So all these techniques and skills, you know, are just really just handed down from generation to generation.
So you did that for 6 months,
did the course,
training,
yeah.
The training?
Yep, and passed out of Risington, and then I was posted up to RAF Leeming. Between Harrogate and North Allerton in North Yorkshire, doing basic flying training.
Is this in 64? No, sorry.
Finished this 1970. Finished at CFS just about. I think it was just about at Christmas in 67. So then went up to Leam and started really at the start of that year. Basic flying training school. Which I enjoyed the basic flying. I mean, none of the guys wanted to go to Valley on the Nats doing advanced flying training. But I found it very satisfying taking somebody who'd never flown an airplane in their life before, and then taking them through to a stage where you know they were getting on towards their wing standard, and that was good fun.
And what were you teaching them?
On the Jet Provost again. So you learn a lot about the instruction really on the job, how to deal with people, and you can go through the patter and get get used to doing it, so you don't have to think about it. You know what's coming next, and it was a nice station, nice squadron, nice guys. I enjoyed the job.
Which squadron was this?
I was on three. Each the FDSs just have their own. 1, 2, 3 squadron, or depending how many flying training squadrons there are, and so they got an identity within the station, but not within the Air Force. So I was on 3 squadron there, and it was still a time when the Air Force was a reasonable size, and then a lot of people coming through, a lot of training going on, and we were starting a family. We had twin daughters then, and so a lot of young people on the station. Nice station, active station. I enjoyed the job. It was nice.
Mm. Were you there for long?
About 2.5 years, I think. Two and a half to 3 years. Then I was posted down to a strange job at the Royal Radar Establishment at Pershaw, down near Evesham, and that's when I went back onto Hastings. Which was not on the script at all.
So let me just check. So which? Yeah. When are we up to now in terms of time?
1970. Yeah. Yes, I think 70 to 72 was at Pershaw. That was an interesting job because I went back to fly the Hastings, But because it was a sort of research establishment, a radar research establishment, we there were not that many of us there, and there was just basically the only RAF were the aircrew. There was a station commander, a group captain, station commander, a wing commander, and a bunch of squadron commander, and then just the aircrew. There were no, the admin staff was all civil. It was administrative technology at that stage. But it was interesting because I flew the Hastings and the Varsity, and then I also got checked out on the Canberra, which was at the end of its operational life in those days. But it was used a lot for radar research purposes.
So can you explain to people what you were actually doing?
Right. Let's take the Hastings. The Hastings, one of the big things coming in at that stage was infrared. They discovered, obviously, the use of infrared. And if you can get an infrared pattern off things, you can tell all sorts of things. Like if you fly over an airfield and you've got an infrared camera on the dispersal where aeroplanes stand, if an aeroplane was there within the last couple of hours, you can tell because the heat pattern where the aeroplane was standing is different from the heat pattern if there had been no aeroplane there. So all sorts of things you can detect by getting a heat pattern. So this was the early days of infrared, and we were flying scientists around, one of whom was an absolute mad scientist, he really was. But they had their kit down the back, so they would come in and brief us, right, we want to go to so-and-so. And one of the favourite places was a government place just down the road, a big supply, ordnance supply depot, which had roofs, sloping roofs, on their warehouses. And of course, this reflected all different sorts of heat. So this was the sort of thing we did. So we would, go low level, mainly, and just fly over all these targets. At one stage, we went up to Norway to have a look at flying over snowy conditions with troops on the ground. Because, again, if you're flying over snowy conditions and there are troops on the ground, they are generating heat, and you can spot them with an infrared. So this is the sort of development of equipment to eventually go into RAF frontline aircraft. But again, lots of low flying. Another project we did, which a friend of mine who was a similar age to me, we were the two youngest on at the place, they had a guy had come up with this idea that if you had a radar altimeter, normally it's either done on atmospheric pressure, and then you had the radio altimeter, which was a radio frequency, but he was trying to develop a radar. Now, he wanted to fly over waves to see if he could differentiate between the top of a wave and the bottom of the wave, and he wanted to fly over waves at 0 feet. So Don and I, because the other guys didn't want to know about it, the older, wiser guys, we used to go out in a Varsity over the Bristol Channel, and we'd fly up and down the Bristol Channel at 0 feet, literally clear to 0 feet, with this guy down the back checking if his altimeter. all sorts of ideas that people had for developing equipment, a lot of which was well on and was being developed into working systems. But it was when we were flying the aeroplanes, they could develop that equipment to eventually come into operational service. A little bit short on flying, I appreciate it because I flew the Canberra quite a lot, which was good. Just something completely different for me. But an interesting environment with interesting flying and different flying. And I say, low level at night, that was something else we did. Somebody was developing a laser, which I forget what the actual use for it was to be, but anyway, he wanted this laser and he wanted it doing at night. So we were very carefully planning what routes we flew, but we were, again, it was Don and I, I think, were flying this thing with this laser device on the front to check if he could develop it into a piece of equipment.
I'm just trying to get my head around how you actually fly at night quite that low level.
Well, you choose a good night for a start. Yes, you've got some definition, but if you you've got to plan the route carefully, and it was only a limit, perhaps a 20-mile leg, so you knew that there was nothing, there were no pylons or anything untoward, and so you would set up at probably on the radio altimeter at 250 feet and just fly up and down like that. But interesting and a bit challenging, but I'd say if you went about it sensibly, it was okay.
And tell me about flying the Canberra.
Canberra, lovely aeroplane. I enjoyed flying it. The reason I could get checked out there rather than doing a full course was that you were basically just flying the airframe. And flying an airframe, they're all much the same, be it a Comet or a Shackleton or Varsity or what. The difficulty you get, and where operational conversion units do the big job, is doing the operational work on that aeroplane. How to bomb, how to do maritime work. That's the thrust of it. I mean, flying the airframe is the basic thing, and not too difficult. So that's why I could do it there rather than going to an OCU. And we had several versions. We had a B6 / B2. We had a PR3, T4, PR7, which I also flew. And then we also had something which I didn't fly, which was the short conversion 9, which is a PR9, again adapted with some fancy nose on it, with some fancy equipment in it. But that was quite specialised, so I didn't fly that one. And it was really just a question of sitting there and trying to cope with each one, because each one was slightly different in fuel management and things like that, and the fuel tankage was different, and so you had to make sure you were feeding from the right fuel tank at the right stage. The Canberra killed a lot of people because a problem I talked about earlier on about jet engines having a slow wind-up time, and the thing you had to be wary of within the Canberra was on finals, particularly if you were practicing asymmetric, that once you got below a certain height, if you decided it was not going right and you wanted to overshoot, that the wind-up time on the engine was very slow, and also the asymmetric forces were impossible to cope with. So a lot of people died in the operational world, now getting that wrong. So that was the sort of thing you had to be careful of. But basically, a lovely aeroplane, and you could sit up there quite happily for long periods and enjoy some good flying. And so I wouldn't have got my hands on anything like that. The route I'd gone down with the Air Force, with really transport and training, is what I did. So it was nice to get my hands on something a bit different.
And what came next?
I was promoted out of there. And I went off to do schools liaison and recruiting. I went off to Stanmore and did a course on all the right way to recruit people and to fill in attestation papers and this sort of thing.
Can I just check what date are we at now?
Now you're asking, aren't you? It'll be 72-ish. Yeah, about 72, 73. So I did the course there, and I was posted, as they call it, as an area commander up to Yorkshire, up to Hull, and that was my area, mainly schools liaison, but also as the ultimate boss of the recruiting office, which there was a flight lieutenant who mainly ran the recruiting. Halfway through the course, they said, they're building the Humber Bridge. Therefore, we want to combine East Yorkshire with Lincolnshire, so we'd like you to take over Lincolnshire as well. So having had a look to buy a house perhaps in near Hull, we then decided we'd move into quarters at Swinderby in Lincolnshire, just south of Lincoln. And so I had finished the course, went up to Lincolnshire, moved into a quarter at Swinderby, on the coldest day of the year, with a heating system that wasn't working, with two young children and a very young baby, which was fun, and proceeded to do a couple of years there. It was Humber Bridge was never built in the time I was there, so I used to go up and down, and my patch went from Stamford up to Whitby. I used to have to go across the Humber on the ferry, which became known in the family as Daddy's Boat. So I would pitch up there in a little RAF Morris Traveller and go on the boat if I was going across to the office in Hull. And on occasion I took the kids with us too. We used to do little shows and then go to shows and take the RAF recruiting set up there. And so I'd show up there with the family, and having crossed on Daddy's Boat on the Humber Ferry. And it was an interesting tour, not what I would have chosen, but I enjoyed going out and meeting going to the schools and chatting to people and meeting different people and doing something I wouldn't normally do. The main thing I enjoyed about it was I was my own boss. My wing commander, and my next immediate, was at Stanmore in London. And I remember going at one period for 3 months. I didn't even talk to him on the telephone. I just got on and did it, and that was lovely. I enjoyed that.
Can you describe a typical school visit for me?
Yeah. You develop a sort of pattern, which depends on... Normally, I went to... not exclusively, because I didn't believe in that, but normally I would go to the old grammar schools or a comprehensive, looking at officer type selection people. So I had a patter again, a talk, which I developed. There were some recruiting films as well, which showed all the good side of service life. So I'd pitch up to the school, meet the careers master, perhaps meet the headmaster. Interesting people to talk to, and it was good for me to meet people doing something completely different with different problems that I wouldn't comprehend. And nice people in the main to talk to. Got a good assessment of the problems of comprehensive education with the sheer numbers of people that a headmaster had to deal with, just staff, let alone pupils. So pitch up the school, meet the careers master, go into a room or a hall, or depending on the numbers. Give them a talk on what the Air Force consisted of. And I think the big thing was, of course, people tend to think Air Force is aeroplanes, and so that's all there is. But, of course, there's so much else goes on that's needed. And show them the film, ask any questions. If somebody wanted an interview or a chat or was seriously thinking about it, then perhaps I have a chat with them or fix up an appointment for them to come into the office to talk about it. But mainly, I think, sowing the seeds and putting the idea there that this is a career and this is what you need to do and this is what it's got to offer.
And which aspects of service life got played up? You said they played up the good bits.
Well, what I can remember is they had a phantom pilot on one of the films, this guy who was... the phantom, flying phantoms was obviously a good thing. But then he was posted out to America on an exchange tour, and I can remember he was near New Orleans, and I can remember the picture of him and his wife sitting on a riverboat going up the Mississippi and having a lovely dinner in the evening with the banjo music going on and this sort of thing, which is fair enough, I suppose. You know, it happens. I mean, I've done plenty of good things like that, so I can't complain. But so that's the sort of thing it played up.
And how long did you do that for?
I did that for a couple of years, and then I was short-toured from that, and I was posted on back onto flying onto the Belfast.
So 74?
No, this must be going on to... I can look it up in my logbook to get the chronology right. Yeah, 74, 75, because, again, it was back onto an OCU, an operational converting, at Bryars Norton this was. So yes, posted down to there. Bryars Norton was my best tour ever, obviously, was Changi. That was wonderful. Bryars Norton was very good, before I get on to the actual course, because it was a big station. There were two Britannia squadrons there. There was the VC-10 squadron, and there was the Belfast squadron. So a lot of big squadrons, four big squadrons, and a lot of exchange people. And then we had Americans, Canadians, Australians, New Zealanders, and they lived on the patch. And in fact, we lived next door to an American family. And the social life really was out of this world, because everybody was always giving parties. And you could quite literally go for five nights running, you'd be at a dinner or a party or somewhere on the base with nice people, because obviously air forces choose the best people or the most suitable people they feel to go and do these tours. So we had a lovely time, and the kids grew up. Our three kids, in fact, were mixing with the three kids, the American kids next door, and they got on like a house on fire. So it was a lovely time. I pitched up there into quarters, which was nice. Started the OCU, it was about 6 months, which was hard work. And again, the inevitable ground school. Learning all sorts of things about how the engine worked, which you never need to know, and was completely pointless, but the Air Force insists that you learn. And doing the flying. Didn't come easily, that flying, because it was strategic transport, a much more modern aeroplane, doing things I'd not really done before. So it was hard work. Got through the course,